Good morning, this is Linda, and I'll be reading the Decatur Herald and Review for the date of April 4th, 2017. We'll begin with the article titled, It's Election Day, Here's What You Need to Know, written by Ryan Voiles out of Decatur. Polls are now open in Macon County and will remain so until 7 p.m. today for the consolidated election, which includes races for Decatur City and school leaders. The Herald and Review will check in at the polls and provide updates throughout the day, then offer complete coverage of results tonight. Use the hashtag DecaturVotes to share your observations and opinions on social media. To look up your polling place, to view a Macon County sample ballot, click here. I think that area was probably, should not have been read. My apologies. As of Monday night, a total of 2,660 Macon County residents had already cast their ballots to determine who will represent them at the local level. The number far exceeds early turnout in 2015's local election, which saw a total of 1,727 early and absentee ballots cast. The trend in recent elections has been for residents to vote early, as Macon County Clerk Steve Bean said candidates have done a better job getting their base to the polls before Election Day. However, he said the high early numbers do not necessarily guarantee a greater turnout overall. Just because there's an uptick in early voting doesn't mean there will be more overall voters, he said. I would hope so, but we haven't seen that in the past. Among the races that has drawn the most attention this year is Decatur's mayoral contest, which sees incumbent Mayor Julie Moorwolf facing a challenge from John Phillips, a small business owner and head of the Decatur Public Library Board. Moorwolf has touted support from local union and business leaders as proof she is someone who can build coalitions and move the city forward. Phillips, who has mostly self-funded his campaign, has said he wants to bring a new perspective to city leadership. One issue that has come up throughout the campaign has been the role of City Manager Tim Gleason. Moorwolf has thrown her support behind Gleason, while Phillips said he wants to offer coaching and guidance to the City Manager. Moorwolf has served as mayor since 2015, having been appointed to the role after the death of Mayor Mike McElroy. Phillips has served on the library board since 2013 and has served as president since 2015. Several new faces are guaranteed to join the Decatur City Council, as incumbents Jerry Dawson and Chris Funk are not seeking re-election. Incumbent Pat McDaniel and five others will be on the ballot to fill the three open spots on the council. Aside from McDaniel, those candidates are Andrew Appel, Chris Riley, Chuck Kuhl, David Horn, and Marty Watkins. The Decatur School Board has also attracted significant interest, with eight candidates seeking the four open seats. Those include current board members B.A. Butts and Alita Graham, as well as Courtney Carson, Al Scheider, Beth Creighton, Beth Nolan, and Kendall Briscoe. The latter three campaigned together as the Parents in Leadership for Us group. Janice Gavin is also running as a write-in candidate. Several challengers have arisen in the Decatur Township, though there are no contests for the roles of supervisor, clerk, or highway commissioner. Incumbent assessor Vicki Sheets is being challenged for the office by former township trustee Mark Younker, while six candidates are vying for four trustee spots. Democratic trustee candidates are Lori Randall, Melverta Wilkins, and incumbents Amy Roof and Michael Smith. Republican candidates are Gerald Seabach and incumbent trustee Tom Grianias, who was appointed to the board in December. Contested races outside the city of Decatur are few and far between. Of the 174 races in Macon County, 120 can be considered no contest, with another 23 having too few candidates for the available positions. Other contested races include the Richland Community College Board of Trustees, Warrensburg President, Blue Mound President, Maroa Mayor, and Mount Zion School Board. Once again, voters across the county will be able to weigh in on whether to raise money for the Macon County Sheriff's Office through a sales tax increase of 25 cents on every $100 spent on tangible goods. Also known as the Law Enforcement Safety Tax, the measure would help restore several cuts made by the office and help fill a half dozen open positions, officials have said. A similar measure was rejected by voters in November. Voters in Warrensburg will determine whether the village should become a home rule community, while those in Cerro Gordo will vote on an $8 million school building bonds question. If approved, the Cerro Gordo measure would repair and equip the existing junior and senior high school facilities. Outside of Macon County, residents who live within the Taylorville School District are being asked to pay an additional 85 cents per $100 of net assessed value of each individual's property to help provide funding for the district. If it fails, the district would cut just over $1 million for the next school year. Those cuts include eliminating 6 teaching positions, 4 staff positions, as well as scrapping extracurricular programs and junior high, freshman, and junior varsity athletics. If Macon County voters have any questions or want to report a problem, they are asked to call the county clerk's office at area code 217-424-1333 or area code 217-424-1305. That concludes this article. Next, we have Former Caterpillar Boss Engineer's Battle with Deadly Disease, written by Tony Reed and out of Decatur. Ed Rapp, who once headed Caterpillar's Resource Industries Division, visited the Decatur factory Monday to talk about his most challenging engineering project ever, fighting the disease that is trying to kill him. Rapp stepped down from his 37-year career with Caterpillar after being diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, in 2015. It's a progressive neurodegenerative malady that attacks nerves and causes muscles to waste away. You lose your ability to walk, then talk, and then the ability to swallow, Rapp told an audience of more than 180 workers wearing everything from hard hats to ties who were jammed into the Decatur factory's auditorium. And eventually, what gets you is you lose your ability to breathe, he added. Rapp, walking with a limp caused by the disease, perched on a stool and said the typical lifespan after diagnosis is 2 to 5 years. And just for the record, I want it to be noted, I plan on being one of the exceptions to that, he said with a smile as the audience erupted in applause. Rapp traveled from his North Carolina home to raise awareness about the disease as part of a health fair organized by the Caterpillar Factory's African American Network Employee Resource Group. Many in the audience knew Rapp. Others knew him by reputation as a Caterpillar manager who had served all over the world and had helped guide the company during some of its most successful years. Now his creative energies are devoted to building a personal health care regimen that involves strict diet and even acupuncture and wider efforts aimed at furthering the cause of ALS research. He is one of the patients being studied to create a vast database of ALS information that will be available to researchers worldwide without restriction. It will have 6 billion data points on me alone, he said, and I am one of 1,000 patients. He is also bringing his engineering knowledge to bear to drive the development of mechanical and technological aids to help ALS patients cope with their failing bodies as the deed progresses. What constantly impressed his audience, however, and brought them to their feet at the end in a standing ovation, was Rapp's sense of courage and calm acceptance of the disease that had re-engineered his life, hopes, and dreams. A manager who used to teach a class on work-family-life balance, the 60-year-old father and grandfather said he was ready to handle catastrophe because he had a loving family behind him and a strong faith in God. He urged his audience to build on similar relationships and use the most underutilized tool we have, the mind, to fight back when trouble strikes. At some time in every one of our lives, life is going to throw us a curveball. An illness, a death in the family, a personal trauma or tragedy, he said. I always say the time to start preparing to hit the curveball is not when it leaves the pitcher's hand. It's in how you live your life each and every day. That concludes the article on Ed Rapp. Our next article is out of Springfield from the Associated Press and is titled, Illinois Senate President Promotes Proposed Immigrant Protection Legislation. Illinois Senate Democrats contending that immigrants are hiding in their homes because of aggressive actions by President Donald Trump's administration promoted legislation Monday that would bar law enforcement from entering state-supported schools or health facilities without a warrant looking for immigrants in the country illegally. Senate President John Cullerton said his trust, and that is in quotes and all capitals, T-R-U-S-T, act is a response to growing anxiety in immigrant communities because of federal raids and anti-immigrant rhetoric from the new Republican president. A U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement raid on Chicago's northwest side last week led to the shooting of a man by an agent. We're drawing a bright line between do's and don'ts for police, Cullerton told a Chicago news conference hosted by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. A crackdown on illegal immigration has been a cornerstone of Donald Trump's presidency. He has pursued a promised wall on the U.S.-Mexican border, threatened to withhold funds from so-called sanctuary cities, and immigrant advocates have questioned whether ICE, that's all capitals, I-C-E, has carried out more raids in cities. It all spells anxiety for immigrant communities, said State Senator Iris Martinez, who noted the sudden abandonment of commercial districts in neighborhoods such as Rogers Park and Albany Park. The last 3 or 4 weeks, those areas are very isolated, and that is because people are not coming out to shop, the Chicago Democrat said, and that is because of the fear they've seen ICE walking around. California adopted the nation's first Trust Act in 2014. Andy Kang, director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice and a primary author of the Illinois adaptation, said Oregon, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Vermont have similar laws. New York and Maryland are considering versions. The measure has 4 main tenets. First, it creates safe zones, barring law enforcement authorities from entering state-supported school or health facilities without a warrant. In addition, no local officers can be deputized as federal officers for an investigation without a warrant. Cullerton stressed that the measure would not keep police from investigating crimes or apprehending suspects. But the prevailing criteria to detain an individual should not be based on someone's citizenship, immigration status, background, or beliefs, but by the blind exercise of the rule of law, Cullerton said. The plan would also set deadlines for police to complete paperwork for immigrant crime victims who cooperate in an investigation. Those who cooperate are eligible for special visas that allow temporary residence, but police are often slow or negligent in completing them. And expanding on the sanctuary city idea, places such as Chicago, Evanston, and Urbana, where immigrants in the in the country illegally are largely left alone, Cullerton's legislation would ban local participation in any sort of registry based on religious, race, or immigrant status. Currently, there is no such registry, and Sheldon Namod, that's spelled N-A-H-M-O-D, a constitutional scholar at Chicago Kent School of Law, said no president would have an easy go in such a registration law being declared constitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court has found that Washington cannot withhold funding as a punitive measure, said Kang. He said it's unlikely a local police department could find itself losing federal dollars for skirting cooperation with the feds. The legislation will have a hearing Wednesday in the Senate Executive Committee. House Democrats have introduced some similar measures to limit local police cooperation and bar immigration authorities from schools, churches, or hospitals without warrants. Republicans have raised objections. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's spokeswoman, Elani Demertzis, D-E-M-E-R-T-Z-I-S, would not comment on whether the governor supports Cullerton's initiative, but said, Illinois is a welcoming and diverse state, and the governor believes in comprehensive immigration reform. That concludes that article. The next article is out of Washington and presented again by the Associated Press, is titled Gorsuch Blocked for Now. Democrats claimed the votes they needed Monday to block President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, but the victory was only fleeting, setting up a historic showdown with Republicans who intend to write Senate rules and muscle Neil Gorsuch onto the high court. The coming fight was assured as the bitterly divided Judiciary Committee voted 11-9 along party lines to send Gorsuch's nomination to the full Senate, where Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky has vowed he will be confirmed on Friday. Short of the 60 votes needed to overcome procedural hurdles, McConnell is ready to lead Republicans in a unilateral voting change so significant in the rules-conscious Congress that it's been dubbed the nuclear option, lowering the confirmation threshold to a filibuster-proof simple majority in the 100-member Senate. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware became the key 41st vote for the Democrats Monday, declaring during committee debate that Gorsuch's conservative record showed an activist approach to the law and that he evaded questions during his confirmation hearings. Coons also said that Republicans' treatment of former President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland left lasting scars after they denied him so much as a hearing following the death of Justice Antonin Scalia early last year. We are at a historic moment in the history of the United States Senate due to actions by both parties, Coons said. We have eroded the process for reaching agreement and dishonored our long traditions of acting above partisanship. The long-term consequences of the coming confrontation could be profound, as the rules change Republicans intend to enact would apply to future Supreme Court nominees too, allowing them to be voted onto the court without any input from the minority party. And though predicting a justice's votes can be difficult, confirmation of the 49-year-old Gorsuch is expected to restore the conservative majority that existed while Scalia was alive, which could then be in place or even expand over decades to come as some of the more liberal justices age. For Republicans and Trump, Gorsuch's confirmation will be a moment of triumph, a bright spot in a troubled young administration that's failed on the legislative front with the health care bill and is under investigation over Russia connections. The nomination of Gorsuch, by contrast, has won universal praise from Republicans, some of whom call his appointment Trump's best move so far as president. Gorsuch has spent more than a decade on the federal appeals bench in Denver, where he's issued consistently conservative rulings, and he appeared on Trump's list of potential candidates partly generated by the Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation during the campaign. Gorsuch's confirmation will also be vindication for McConnell's strategy of refusing to fill Scalia's seat last year, instead leaving it open for the next president, even though few imagined then that person would be Trump. The showdown over the nuclear option expected on the Senate floor Thursday is likely to be accompanied by much hand-wringing from senators bemoaning the decay of the chamber's traditions of bipartisanship and comity. And that's comity. But both parties are to blame. When the Democrats were in the majority, they removed the 60-vote threshold for lower court nominees in 2013 when Republicans were blocking Obama picks to a critical federal court. Republicans said then that the Democrats would come to regret it. Gorsuch will be confirmed, and he should be, the number two Senate Republican John Cornyn of Texas said during Monday's debate. If Judge Gorsuch is unacceptable to our Democratic colleagues, there will never be a nominee by this president that you will find acceptable. Never. Gorsuch now counts 55 supporters in the Senate. The 52 Republicans, along with three moderate Democrats from states Trump won last November, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, and Joe Donnelly of Indiana. A fourth Senate Democrat, Michael Bennett, from Gorsuch's home state of Colorado, has said he will not join in the filibuster against Gorsuch, but has not said he will vote on final passage. Democrats claim the Republicans' treatment of Garland was worse than anything they ever did or are doing, and with Trump in the White House, they are under intense pressure from liberal voters to oppose the president on every front. That gives them very little leeway to let Gorsuch onto the court unchallenged, even though all the current justices were confirmed without filibusters, aside from a half-hearted effort against Justice Samuel Alito. Several Democrats also say Gorsuch has not done enough to demonstrate his independence from Trump at a time when the president has frequently assailed the judiciary and is embroiled in one controversy after another. The independence of our judicial branch has never been more threatened or more important, said Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. The possibility of the Supreme Court needing to enforce a subpoena against the President of the United States is far from idle speculation. And that concludes that article. Our next article is from the local region, and it's out of Pena. Names released. The names of the two children who died in a fire at their Pena home early Sunday were released Monday by the Christian County Coroner's Office. Eliana Graves Emerson, 2, and her brother, 3-month-old Keith Emerson, both died from carbon monoxide inhalation due to smoke and soot from the intense blaze which largely destroyed their home at 808 East 2nd Street. Eliana Graves Emerson was found in her bed in an upstairs bedroom, said the coroner Amy Winans. Her little brother Keith Emerson was found in his crib in a separate upstairs bedroom. Brian Emerson, the father of the children, suffered severe burns trying to save them, and their mother, Ashia Emerson, was also injured, police said. A Pena police officer also tried to reach them along with repeated attempts by Pena firefighters, but all were beaten back by the flames and smoke. The children's bodies were recovered after firefighters managed to knock down the blaze and could safely gain entry. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. More local news out of Decatur. We have an article titled, Council Delays Brush College Road Decision. A decision on whether to terminate a $2 million agreement to design the Brush College Road overpass across the northern Norfolk Southern track yard was delayed Monday. Decatur City Council members asked for more information about the impact of the proposed changes as contractor AECOM, objected to the termination. The changes would have diverted the money to focus on acquiring right-of-way at the intersection of Brush College and Ferries Parkway, which City Manager Tim Gleason said would aid progress on the Macon County Beltway project. We have never been given a notice to proceed on the contract, said John Schwalbach, AECOM Vice President. The funding has been available. We've been ready and continue to be ready to begin work on this contract. The contract was awarded in 2015 with plans to utilize grant money received through the Illinois Jobs Now program, Gleason said. Schwalbach said designing an overpass would lead to being able to alleviate a concern from drivers about the safety of what is currently a narrow tunnel. The overpass would be part of an expansion of Brush College to four lanes, Schwalbach said. Gleason said shifting the funding would put the city and county in a better position to receive federal funding. He said it is not a reflection on AECOM. The city was turned down last summer for a $20 million federal grant that would have gone toward the project. City officials were told by the U.S. Department of Transportation the project was not far enough along to compete against another applicant for grant dollars. The Brush College and Ferries intersection is closer to the Beltway, Gleason said. He said semi-truck traffic patterns could change once the Beltway is constructed. The underpass becomes less of a concern, Gleason said. We do not have the accidents the community thinks we might have. We are dealing with a very real perception. Schwalbach said funding is currently not available for the federal grants the city is seeking, and it is uncertain whether those would be offered again. For one thing, we know for sure it's not in the budget now, Schwalbach said. Councilman Pat McDaniel said he remained confident at least some money will be available. Schwalbach said right-of-way acquisition should not proceed without a design plan in place. He said no design plan is currently in place for the Brush College and Ferries intersection. Council members asked for information from the city's transportation consultant, Ann Schneider, the former Illinois Department of Transportation secretary. Schneider did not attend the meeting and will be invited back along with Schwalbach so council members can talk to both sides at the same time. That concludes that article. I do want to bring up a correction that has been printed. In the March 31st article titled Non-Farm Jobs Unemployment Rate Both Dropped in February, end quote, the dates for the two-day boot camp should have said Wednesday and Thursday, April 19th and 20th. In addition, there will be no job fair held at Richland Community College, the newspaper aired. And now we have an article from Decatur, written by Justin Kahn and titled Recent Infant Murder Emphasizes Child Abuse Message. In the wake of the murder of a six-month-old baby girl in Decatur last week, the annual Macon County CASA and Child First wreath lighting at the Macon County Courthouse on Monday took on an especially somber tone. This isn't one of the happier things we do, but it's something sad that we must deal with. The trauma that these children have to deal with, Macon County CASA Executive Director Steve Miller said. But part of our mission is to alert the community and have them recognize their responsibility for our children. In observance of National Child Abuse Prevention Month, five speakers addressed a small crowd on the steps of the courthouse in intermittent rain, hoping to spread the word about the importance of reporting any sign of abuse. The event fell less than a week after six-month-old Denaya Lewis of Decatur was pronounced dead on March 28th, her cause of death, listed as consistent with shaken baby syndrome. Dwan L. Lewis, 23, has been jailed on charges of first-degree murder in that case. Especially here in Macon County, with a six-month-old passing away due to the fault of a parent, no child should ever have to go through that, CASA Program Director Camille Cochran said, but unfortunately it continues to happen. CASA volunteer Crystal Evans said the entire community needs to address the problem. There's more abuse going on than people are aware, Evans said. If you see something, report it. We need to be a community that's aware and involved, and we can always use more volunteers. This is Linda, and this will conclude the reading of the Decatur Herald and Review for part one. We will resume our reading in just a few minutes after taking a short break, and I hope that you will continue with us. The date of this read is April 4th, 2017.